Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to Bible Study. My name is Paul Rohde. For those of you I haven't had a chance to meet, I'm a pastor in New Ulm, Minnesota. And it's been our privilege this week to work in the book of Exodus. I hesitated when I was asked if we're going to wrap it up this morning because I really hope it won't stop for you. The word is so dynamic and there is so much here. I am grateful for this as a chapter in our reading, but would be delighted in the confidence that we could continue to be united by this word wherever we go. We've been working this week on the edge. I like to talk about the edge between text and our lives, which is to say that out of our experiences, we bring some things to the reading of this text. We believe we come to know the text, understand the text, appreciate the text, various things, be mystified by the text, whatever. But the other side of that edge is the text comes to know us. And we are persuaded of what the scriptures know of what it is to be human. And we'll make some great strides in that today, I think. The thing that started to happen yesterday as we read the passage through the Red Sea and then just the start of the wilderness wanderings is that the edge moves. One thing to articulate freedom when we're in oppression, freedom is from the Pharaoh. If we could get rid of that, freedom from addiction, freedom from oppression. The other direction of that is what freedom is for. And increasingly, the book of Exodus pays attention to the bondages of people's own making. They no longer have a Pharaoh, but find themselves bound to hunger, bound to all kinds of things, bound to spoils, the chapter we aren't going to get to study. So today we'll work on 19 and 20. Call it Covenant of Freedom or Covenant of Memory. Chapter 19. On the third new moon, after the people of Israel had gone forth out of the land of Egypt, on that day they came into the wilderness of Sinai. And when they set out from Rephidim and came into the wilderness of Sinai, they encamped in the wilderness. And there Israel encamped before the mountain. And Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him out of the mountain, saying, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the people of Israel, you have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you will obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my own possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me an assembly of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak to the children of Israel." So Moses came and called the elders of the people and set before them all these words which the Lord had commanded him. And all the people answered together and said, "All that the Lord has spoken, we will do." I love it. I'm really glad. I guess I'm at a place of freedom from responsibility for what other people do, so that when somebody says, "Whatever God says, that's what I do." Good. I'm glad. And I'm also really glad that the Bible is aware of about how long that lasts. and how consistently that is played out. And Moses reported the words of the people to the Lord. Here's Moses, the communication's going both ways. And the Lord said to Moses, "Lo, I am coming to you in a thick cloud, that the people may hear when I speak with you, and may also believe you forever." Then Moses told the words of the people to the Lord. And the Lord said to Moses, "Go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow, and let them wash their garments and be ready by the third day. For on the third day the Lord will come down upon Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. And you shall set bounds for the people round about, saying, 'Take heed that you do not go up into the mountain or touch the border of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall be put to death. No hand shall touch him, but he shall be stoned or shot. Whether beast or man, he shall not live.' When the trumpet sounds a long blast, they shall come up to the mountain. So Moses went down from the mountain to the people and consecrated the people, and they washed their garments. And he said to the people, be ready by the third day. Do not go near a woman. The word holy literally means set apart. Consecration is about making space. Setting something apart for a specific purpose, for a specific time, it's bounds around so that it is protected. And in that protection, I believe, comes a whole lot of power. We're starting here because this is about the preparation to listen. Can you imagine 3 days of getting ready to listen? Something is going to happen. Something will be spoken. God is going to speak to the people. Get ready. There are rituals of cleansing. They include sexual restraint. That's what that last phrase was about. The washing of garments, ceremonial and ritual washing of the body, focus, preparation, listening, taking heed. It is what silence does so well. And what I believe is so foreign for us. I hear it being tried around the village. We'll have a moment of silence before we speak the prayer of thanksgiving at the table. Just a moment of silence. And do you hear how hard it is to accomplish? I mean, even here, even a moment. And can you imagine 3 days of it? 3 days of nothing happening except getting ready for something to happen. I think it would be very powerful. And before I say anything more about it, I'm going to read the rest of the chapter. On the morning of the third day, there were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud upon the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast, so that all the people who were in the camp trembled. Then Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they took their stand at the foot of the mountain. And Mount Sinai was wrapped in smoke, because the Lord descended upon it in fire, and the smoke of it went up like the smoke of a kiln, and the whole mountain quaked greatly. And as the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him in thunder. And the Lord came down upon Mount Sinai to the top of the mountain. And the Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. And the Lord said to Moses, go down and warn the people, lest they break through to the Lord to gaze, and many of them perish. And also let the priests who come near to the Lord consecrate themselves, lest the Lord break out upon them. And Moses said to the Lord, the people cannot come up to Mount Sinai, for thou thyself didst charge us, saying, set bounds about the mountain and consecrate it. And the Lord said to him, go down and come up bringing Aaron with you, but do not let the priests and the people break through to come up to the Lord, lest he break out against them. I wouldn't be surprised if there are just a couple people here who read the passage and think, boy, I've never seen anything like that before. Or I've never heard anything like that before. What I want to do as we move into our discussion of this is consider whether that's a matter of circumstances, that we've never had a theophany, that is an appearance of God on a mountain, or whether that's a matter of our ears and our eyes. We've never been attentive to what might be being shown around us. We had a professional radio person running our sound system in my former parish, and he showed me one day that there are two ways with a sound system to make something louder. The first way is obviously to crank up the mic. You push up the volume and it gets louder. He said the second way to do it, there are 4 other mics on the system. And he said even though nobody is standing at those mics are all picking up sounds. Shuffling feet, the fans, the blowers, coughing, rustling, all of that is getting picked up in the system and it's being amplified, though you don't realize it. So he said the other way to make it sound louder without getting distortion is leave the speaker's mic where it's at and pull all the other mics back. Here, he said, listen to it. So I talked, and you could just tell when he pulled everything back, I bet it made the speaker sound a third to a half louder, just because there wasn't the distraction of extraneous voices. When I hear the text say, the trumpet got louder and louder, I wonder if they're talking about the trumpet, or if they're talking about 3 days of the people getting quieter and quieter and more attentive and more aware and more attuned. And because the distraction got less, you see what I'm trying to say? The trumpet got louder. There's so few examples of the power of silence. I mean, that's so foreign to our culture and to our experience and everything. It's really even hard to find examples. I have one, and I hope you won't think it's silly or trivial. At Denali National Park in Alaska, some of you been there? Denali? Okay, good. Marvelous place. One of the more recent national parks, so is very advanced in terms of not being intrusive in the environment. The only way in are on the little school buses that the Park Service operates, and they're operated under very severe limitations. One of them is, if there is a sighting of an animal, the bus needs to fall silent, okay? Because noise is also intrusive. So you see a caribou, and the bus stops, and there's a hush, kids and all. Everybody is quiet. It was amazing what it did for the experience, for our attentiveness and our awe and our awareness of all kinds of intricacies, seeing, hearing, smelling, sensing, because of the freedom of distraction, setting bounds round about that there may be holiness, consecration. A person at 7:45 talked about the power of silence in worship last night. The way we managed participation together without sound was, for the person who spoke and for me, a deeply moving sense. There's 3 days of it. Can you imagine 3 days of this sort of preparation? And then the rumbling starts. And there's a quip around the church, at least about pastors around the church, that people in congregations used to stay around for 2 or 3 bad pastors. Now they're not apt to stay around for more than 2 or 3 bad sermons. And the number struck me when I was reading that. I wonder what the odds are of people staying around for 2 or 3 days of preparation for a word. And what would happen to our listening if that happened? See, I wanted to start with Exodus 19, because my fear is that the Ten Commandments have been diminished by familiarity. That we would get to the covenant of Sinai And it's like, oh yeah, we know all that. But the marvelous thing about reading Exodus 19 is the way it sets up this word and invests this word with a kind of power wrought only by that sort of preparation, restraint, so that people would be prepared. And it makes what God says all the more amazing. So you wait 3 days for a word from God, and then you've got thunder and lightning, and Moses speaks to God, and God speaks back in thunder, and there's smoke, and there's fire, and God says, let the people come. And then Moses says, no, God, you got to remember you told him not to. Oh, yeah, that's right. Said bounds round about. And okay, so you got this all set up. It's dramatic and it's woo, big and bold. And then God is going to speak, and God says, take a day off.
What?
It is amazing to me that we don't hear, that we've been talking about power all week. The power of God is over against the power of the Pharaoh. Now we have an opportunity to hear the power of God in the most basic categories of our lives. Be freed in all the most regular, ordinary, routine places you live. And it won't sound like God at all because it just sounds regular, like ordinary routine. See? That importance of space, preparation, and investment that has the capacity here in the text to invest our loyalty and our words and our time and our families and our bodies and our possessions with holiness. Comments? Questions? Reactions?
Silence. Sometimes I have been a performer and I have found that it's necessary for me to be alone and quiet so that there is, I always thought, energy for that moment when I need to be before the larger group.
I think energy is a good word. Very much related to power. Focus is another one.
That's part of it.
That is part of it. Other comments? Questions? Somebody said, silence. To be real truthful, I am feeling a little tired today. And it occurred to me that I could just read this chapter and say, now we're going to be quiet until God would speak. And if I were sleeping, you would be much too polite to notice. Well, we have this preparation, this very intense and deliberate and long preparation. And I think that it has import for us not only in worship, certainly in worship, but in living. In our attentiveness to the way time and reflection, deliberateness, space, so that there can be energy and focus. I am thinking about that for 3 uninterrupted weeks with my kids. Seeing them most of the day, all the time. It is really wonderful. As opposed to seeing them a few minutes in the morning and seeing them a few minutes at night. And the power of distraction. A friend of mine is a principal of an elementary school. And recently became a grandfather and all kinds of other things. And his last email, he said, it seems like so much has happened. I yearned for time to take it all in. And this is not to suggest that we try to set up an expectation that all of life is going to be thunder, lightning, and mountaintop experiences. Nothing could be further from the biblical word. But the opposite of that would be to say that life has moments and we may not see them. We, in fact, do not see them, do not hear, are not attentive, and the text is wanting to point us to a consecration that is a setting apart bounds so that we may be ready to hear. Okay, any other comments or reactions?
I think a lot of people prepare for holding that way.
even just packing your suitcase and realizing you're coming and whatever travel time you have to get here. You know, this is my second time here, and last year I didn't know what I was coming to, so I didn't have that experience. But I think anytime you're going back to what has been for you a sacred place or a very meaningful vacation time, you in fact prepare yourself for it that way and set it aside time-wise and space-wise for us to arrive.
Well, and I was thinking, even just on a regular Sunday morning service, the prelude is a preparation or a time for silence and preparation and focus. And I suppose that's why people like the quiet, solemn kind of prelude rather than the loud, shocking kind of thing. Those of us that have been organists know that people don't like the real shocking kind of prelude. They like more the solemn, quiet in most cases. And there's maybe some merit to that.
I guess what worries me about when we're talking about being ready is, we say getting ready for coming to hold and are getting ready for church. For me, those are important preparation times too. But when we're talking about finding or seeing God in life, it might not be just when you come to hold and or just when church. And it's all the time in life. And it kind of worries me about trying to be prepared all the time. Because it wouldn't just be sitting down and getting quiet for 1 hour service. It would be for an entire life. And that seems like a muscle that would tire after a while.
Right. That starts to feel like trying to sustain a mountaintop. Mm-hmm. Hold on to that. I agree with you. I think the covenant may in fact have some things to say about the rhythm of time. Go ahead, Jim.
One of the things that I think pastors struggle with is that you have in worship a captive audience, so that you want to get as much information to them as possible. But what that does is it compromises, so there are sometimes the announcements are longer than the sermon. What happens is that we fail to understand the liturgical worship as an experience, that it's something you enter into. And it's not to be interrupted with stuff, extraneous things, that you allow yourself and the liturgy is constructed in such a way so that it is not constantly interrupted with things other than the experience.
Yeah. Go ahead.
When you're talking about avoiding the Ten Commandments because of the familiarity, you know, in dealing with what God, how God sets this up. A lot of years ago, when I was attending the ordination of a friend in Wadena, Minnesota, and she had interned out here in Wenatchee, Washington, and her intern supervisor, Obi Fielson, who's now pastor in Idaho, came to Wadena, Minnesota to preach for her ordination. And he had chosen, Exodus 19, the covenant text, the presentation of God's relationship with people for married ordinations. And one of the readers was Daniel Simonson, who teaches the Old Testament at Luther Seminary. And I was one of the readers, too, and I was sitting next to Dan while the sermon was going on. And Obi went right on saying, you know, this is what God does. What God does is establishes covenant with us, a relationship. You know, forget about the 10 words that come afterwards. And Dan the whole time kept saying, he's got it right. He's got it right. They never get it right. You know, seminary professor going, finally a pastor out there who understands, you know, the Old Testament God's covenant with the people of Israel. And that came to mind as you were setting this up for us, Paul, in terms of understanding what's happening at this great moment for the people, even though God couldn't remember what they were supposed to do.
Yeah, it is so about not only our attentiveness, but what Nancy's comment helps us say is this is going to be God's attentiveness, God's commitment. So let's read it, okay? And so Moses went down to the people and told them, and God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me. There was a marvelous person at 7:45 who came up after the discussion to say, you know, you're always calling this covenant. He said, that sounds like a two-way street. He said, the Ten Commandments sounds like a one-way street. Explain that to me. I said, okay. The Ten Commandments sound like you do this, you do that, you do this, you do that, right? The covenant says, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, by whose power you were delivered. All right? I'm going to do this. And I am going to protect your freedom and imbue your lives with my very presence in all these other ways, these 10 words. I mean, I like to call them 10 words or something. In many ways, it's very much like the rhythm of manna. God is giving gift here. God gave bread in Exodus 16, and we heard, and gave it on God's terms. So the sixth day, there was twice as much, and it didn't spoil. They still were looking for it, of course, but it wasn't there. And so now we have God giving God's very self for the sake of the freedom, the life, the community of the people. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a graven image, or any likeness, or anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the parents upon the children to the third and the fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. For any of us whose experience of the covenant is in Luther's Small Catechism, we're a little surprised by this paragraph appearing here. Luther includes his business about God's jealousy as a conclusion to the commandments at the end of the ten, and subsumes the graven images under idolatry. You shall have no other gods before me, therefore no graven images. Our Reformed Presbyterian churches number the commands differently, and this is command number two. And then they have one coveting commandment, where Luther ends up with two coveting commandments, just because he knows there needs to be 10. The heritage has always been Decalogue, 10 words. The reason Luther didn't make this as explicit in his numbering is because of his appreciation for art, for music, and for the visual arts, but particularly for music. Now, he's mindful, and we can all be called to attentiveness for the way artistic representations of God can be idolatrous. I mean, in that respect, it fits under the first commandment very nicely. But Luther's willing to allow, to challenge the word, that they also can be very helpful as gifts. I suspect we ought to say something about jealousy of God and the iniquity visited to the third and fourth generations and the steadfast love to thousands. I'm amazed how seldom we even hear the numbers. The first two numbers are 3 or 4. The second number is thousands. There's a very intense comparison being made here. But that word about 3 or 4 and impact on children is so haunting. So many times, the thousand isn't even heard. The text is making utterly clear that in any discussion about God's judgment and God's mercy, let there be no question which is more powerful. and which will be sustained over longer time. It is haunting that iniquity is visited on subsequent generations, probably because it's so clearly true. I hate to make the older I get kinds of statements, because I sound as old as I am, I guess. But the older I get, the more clear that becomes, that the consequences of actions continue. I mean, we've already seen that in the book. Even after the Pharaoh is dead, the oppression continues, but the mercy conquers. And attentiveness to the God of this covenant, who frees, Luther says, who binds in order that he may free, binds God's self to us and us to God. And the reason I wanted to make this to work deliberately on chapter 19 is so that this comes out not as just as a list of rules like speed limits and that kind of thing, but comes out as a statement of power about the presence of God in our daily living, in community life, and in our life together, descriptive of how it is that a covenant of freedom unites and strengthens, keeps focus, and energizes. So here we go. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes God's name in vain. I appreciate this translation because vain means empty. Vanity is empty pride. Okay? It's an image that has no content. So many times the commandment gets interpreted, don't swear. The first problem with that is that we see it applied only to a specific list of words, okay? Empty is saying, don't make God's name empty, can apply to all kinds of language we may never even imagine be affected. I think the most common swear word in the world is love, because it is spoken emptily so often, without meaning, without content, without commitment, without intent. So it is empty, therefore it is betrayal. And it threatens the power of language. What's at stake here? I mean, a preacher has a lot at stake here, because a preacher's craft is words. And if words have no power, then so much is lost. So I don't think this is so much saying, don't say them. I think sometimes our cursing vocabulary can be a very powerful prayer vocabulary. Damn cancer. I do not think that violates the command. I mean it. And when it threatens a friend, I mean it intensely. And I believe it is prayer. Damn it. Shatter it. Banish it from the face of our existence. Be damned, okay? It isn't empty, it's full. It's full of the life of a friend, of the fullness of community, of the presence of God. This person, 745, gave you a marvelous example of the habituation of language, that she knew somebody for whom it was sheer habit. And his wife tells the story of his having gone down to a filling station. And the language came, and the attendant at the station said, I'm sorry, but you don't need to swear at me. And the man said, I didn't swear, goddammit. Well, I didn't know what I said. I mean, now one of the things, I mean, there's a sense in which this points to intent of language, but there's another sense in which this is aware that language may have effect whether or not it's intended. That if somebody curses someone, even if they would quickly say, oh, I didn't mean it. The Bible has this view of words that says, still that person or that part of creation is diminished. And I think my most intense concern is that if language is, first of all, if language is used emptily, if God's language is used emptily, and so one of the other things that comes to be challenged here is some of the pious ways we may use God's name without awareness that we are speaking or mean to be speaking of the power of the universe, which calls for a certain humility when this is spoken. That first of all, the very power of language is threatened. But secondly, especially if the words are used for trivial kinds of things, if we use our strongest language for mosquito bites and paper cuts, then what do we have for cancer or AIDS or war or genocide? What we have emptiness. We are, and what I hear people doing is just trying to string more and more words together. You know, one time I gave a confirmation quiz. You learn how to phrase questions after a while, but the question was just, vulgarity is, and I left a blank, expecting my students to say, language that degrades human beings. Okay? Instead, my student gave me a list. Vulgarity is, and I read it and thought, well, I guess I asked for it. but I want to be clear that it doesn't apply only to the profane or only to the vulgar. It applies to all words about God, all attributes, names, descriptions, study, discussion. Questions?
Just wanted to comment, Paul, that the New RSV translation is, you shall not make wrongful use of the name of the Lord your God, which really picks up on the kind of theme that you're sharing. The other thing is the importance of the idea of the name, that a name is the identity of the one that's spoken of. So the name God is God. So it's not just misusing the name of God, it's misusing God's very identity for wrongful purposes.
And is present even when it's not intended. Because we remember our discussion, I am who I am and cannot be other. In contrast to humans who can say it but not mean it, that I am who I am cannot. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. I wonder if the text has encountered some of the same argument that I've encountered when I've attempted just to speak and people say, but I have to work. I have work to get done. The text clearly knows that. 6 days you shall labor, and here's the rhythm of time. Once again, be silent. Take time in the presence. Set bounds around time so that time itself be invested with the God of life. The seventh day is the Sabbath to the Lord your God. I hear people more and more saying, kind of smugly, it's my day. It's my day. I preached a sermon recently in which I said, well, if it's your day, why should you expect it to be any different than any other day? And beneath it, I mean, beneath all the words, all the other words, the reason Dan Simonson, I suspect, was so excited about the focus on the first word is, and who is your God? Who rules our time? In it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your manservant or your maidservant, or your cattle, or the sojourner who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Where there's a concern about always being prepared and how that would, in fact, be another bondage. I think the text says just a day. One day to be prepared and to be ready to work. There's a description here of mountain and valley, of time that is rhythmic, okay? And a freedom in those rhythms. How much talk of time do you hear that has the slightest acknowledgement of freedom? I hear almost none. Time is only a bind, and there is not enough of it. And the faster we go, the more true it is. Jürgen Moltmann has written powerfully about this because he was working on this in the 1970s. He's a German theologian. When the energy crisis first kind of came to consciousness, fuel conservation, the conservation of fossil fuels, one of the things that happened in Germany is they declared an automobile-free day. No cars for one Sunday in all of Germany. Do you think they were miserable? People brought their card tables out into the streets. Children played soccer on the Autobahn. They had a blast. It was a free day. It really was a free day. And Moltmann started to write a theology of the environment out of it because he was persuaded that a recovery of a Sabbath theology is essential to our balance with the environment, that it would reduce consumption of resources by more than a seventh. Because if people experience delight one day a week, they might just find some space for delight a little more often, for rest, for a view of time that is rhythmic rather than that is bound. Comments? Questions? You really are into this silence thing, aren't you? Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land which the Lord your God gives you. You shall not kill. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his manservant, or his maidservant, or her ox, or her ass, or anything that is your neighbor's. Again, we come full circle in a couple ways, because it seems to me that the first commandment is trying to say, want your God. And so then the last commandment says, pay attention even to your wants. The covenant, I think, is painfully aware of how quickly and how easily we become bound again, trapped again, caught again, that we forget. Forgetfulness is part of this. Way back in the first chapter, when we read the situation, and then we read chapter 2, which goes from this horrible nationwide oppression to saying one man from the tribe of Levi married a woman from the tribe of Levi and they bore a son. And we talked there about the power of particularity and of the movement of the text to the particular. I want to claim that again here in the covenant, that I am the Lord your God, you shall have no other gods. I am a God of freedom who set you free from the bondage to Pharaoh. Remember it. Live by it. The power of God in cosmic, eternal categories is very non-threatening, frankly. But the text moves again to the particular, to families, to physical life, to sexuality, even to our possessions, our freedom to be exercised. And so, obviously, we don't have time to make a study of each of them, but we hear them all protecting, setting bounds about the freedom. It's not the content of the freedom. The content of the freedom is in the Exodus, in the gift of God, in the beginning. You don't have to say that. But the limit of freedom is not there. It's stretched to every part of our living.
Paul?
Go ahead.
Would you comment a little bit on why the prohibition against, you don't honor your father and your mother, you're in big trouble, but if you kill somebody, there's no prohibition. And there's nothing specific about it.
Well, actually, I mean, it isn't threat with honor your father and mother. It's promise that your days may be long. The one command to which a promise can be attached. Britta Stendahl did a wonderful thing in a little book called Sabbatical Reflections. They had emigrated from Sweden to the United States and then gone back to Sweden on sabbatical. And she was journaling and then realized that she could group her reflections under the rubrics of this covenant. So she published it in a book called Sabbatical Reflections. And with honor your father and mother, she included the writings that were the pain of immigration, what it was to leave by ship from Sweden and watch her parents stand at the shore and wave to them, and how powerful for her that they became so small. And what does it mean to honor your parents when they're an ocean away? That was the first part of the writing. But then they went back for sabbatical. And they started to drive her crazy. Because they are real people, you know? That's the one thing you can be sure of. They are real people. And she is spinning this promise that's attached to the command and concludes with the power of honoring parents, because she then, I suppose 10 years older than she was when they left Sweden, is realizing more and more how much she's like her parents. And so she writes about honoring the father and mother within you. You are like them. And that to fail to honor them limits your own capacity to embrace your own humanity, because it will be so reflective of who they are. And I don't know if you know adult children who despise their parents. I have known some and be stunned to silence at how much like their parents they become, in that absolute refusal that they would be anything except like the one they continue to despise. We talk about irony, the power of irony. So it seems to me there's something there. I mean, I'm just using Britta's wisdom for reflecting on length of life and the way, I mean, even as the way failure of one generation has impact on the next. The iniquity is visited. The poetry says so kind of gently, a visitation. That the honor of memory, of history, of those who precede us, closest to us, has something to do with the length of our days. and with the extent to which they be filled with promise? I don't know, does any of that ring true for you?
I wonder, you seem to touch on it right there at the end. It's a recognition that we are the cumulative knowledge and experience of all the past. And if we reject that, can we live as long? Can we survive if we, because the failures die. It's what we've learned that keeps us going.
Anyone else? I mean, and I don't know why there isn't a threat attached to any of the other commands. I mean, that, by its absence, maybe that is sort of striking. I don't know. Go ahead.
I think perhaps we add a threat at the end of each one, or else. And I think once I got past that, I saw these as gifts.
Yeah.
The or else disappeared.
Yeah. I don't view the so that you may live long as a threat.
No, I don't either.
It's a promise.
It's a promise, yeah.
And the others are liberating, not or else, but so that you may live well. You can't live well if you're killing each other.
That's where I think it's helpful to have that covenant word in verse 2, I am the Lord your God who brought you off. Put that in front of each of the commandments.
In front of each of the commandments.
Therefore, almost like Pauline theology. You know, you have the gospel that's given, and then you have the therefore.
Mm-hmm. And, when we have the or else suggestion, it makes me think about how we hear the word shall. You shall. It's a different word than you have to. I mean, the way we work at these freedoms in our home is by trying to say, you get to. You get to practice the piano. It's your turn. You sound suspicious.
I was just going to say that the piece that I like about these last words, I mean, there isn't any, there's no Mickey Mousing around here. You shall not murder. That's it. When you think of how many times there's so many words added on to everything, and this is just straight and to the point, and that's it. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. And to me, it's clear and concise.
I've heard these referred to as, and I don't appreciate it, the 10 suggestions.
Yeah.
I think if they were the 10 suggestions, it would say, you may,
or you may not.
You shall says, you better.
You shall is indicative. Mm-hmm. It's in the indicative. It's not in the imperative mood. Mm-hmm. Though most of the time, tone of voice tends to be imperative. Which is why some of the things we get to do, honoring father and mother, remember the Sabbath day, you get to remember. You get to hear and sing and bask and eat the story.
I'm a little concerned in that we have Pauline theology to this, which says I'm no longer under the law, but under the gospel. Mm-hmm. And then how does one live one's life under the gospel without the regulation of law, where the reality is that you take very seriously, as seriously as we do in the Lutheran Church, then Christian ethics are an oxymoron. So, how do you theologically fit this in?
Well, first of all, I think the Pauline comment was about order, gospel law.
Right.
And that the gospel is more powerful. And then the law becomes indicative mood, descriptive, not imperative, but particular. And some of what is so important about these words is their particularity. And that's some of the threat of a graven image, is that a graven image is also particular, but it is only one representation, one interpretation, and therefore must not be regarded as the thing itself. It represents that thing. And so one of the necessities of the description, it seems to me, Jim, is to keep it particular, to keep it engaged with those real categories in which we live. So that if we want to say that Christian ethics is an oxymoron, I hear where you're going with that, I think, Christian discipleship is not. That to follow the gospel, to be empowered by the gospel, would be as specific as the person next to us.
Okay, but it is, I have a problem with that because it sounds like you're smuggling in the law back in as a regulatory agency for the Christian life. And that's problematic because it does subtract from the gospel. It does take away from the gospel. It says that the gospel is not enough. Luther said you no longer have to tell the Christian to love any more than you have to tell a rock that has been standing in the sun to give off heat.
Yeah.
So just go with that a little bit.
Somebody else wants to make
a comment. I think it kind of goes, it seems to me that the law and the gospel, it's like we talked about yesterday, the turning from, or as you put it, and I almost like it better, turning to.
Yeah.
Focusing on God, we live the law. And as we move more to God, we have that grace, and the good news is there. But the closer we get to God, the more we live the law.
Well, if the propellers on the boat go, we'll do Galatians next week. How's that? Jim is pushing us in a very helpful way because I hear him wanting it to be clear that this is a very narrow, precipitous place. That, you know, that you may be pulling the law back in, which has the capacity to undo the freedom altogether. But in Galatians, the same Paul who wrote, "For freedom, Christ has set us free, stand fast there, for and do not submit again to a yoke of slavery," meaning don't pull the law back in, said, do not use your freedom as an opportunity for the flesh. You know, Galatians also gets that specific. So if one, my favorite Martin Luther quote is, a drunk can fall off a horse on two sides, okay? So if you know, Jim is helping us say don't fall off on this side by pulling in the law again, at which point you will have obliterated the gospel of the covenant, and if we can get used to hearing it as a covenant, doesn't say, and don't give in to the chaos of antinomianism.
What? The problem is if we're Calvin brings in the third use of the law, which is that the commandments are now used for the Christian as a guide to the Christian life,
yeah,
is a smuggling back in. The way I've always dealt with it is to say that you have, under the gospel, you have the freedom to go out and kill somebody. You really do. Mm-hmm. You have the freedom to do that. You also have the freedom not to do that.
Yeah.
Because you do have the power to actually end a person's life. Every person on this mm-hmm. planet does that, has that power.
Mm-hmm.
How are you going to use the power?
Yes.
I think that Paul, your words about this being 10 words and that this is indicative and not imperative is helpful in this moment. We call them commandments, which sounds imperative.
It certainly does.
But in the Hebrew, they are indicative. And so what these are instead of commands about what to do or not do in order to connect to God. It's rather God's words about being. You know, it's how we are to be with one another and with God. And so when you do that, I think that helps with Jim's issue. Because then we get the gift of being in Christ. We are what Christ makes us. And then able to be as God intends, even in these 10 words. And that might get a...
And you see, the other thing Luther says is that the extremes are like each other. Because I think you look at the culture, the world one way, and you see the power of the law that is saying, unless you adhere to, and it really that is a legalism. Anytime you make a list that says this is godly, you know, you shall not smoke, you shall not drink, you shall not play cards, right? That is a graven image. And that's the point at which we really need the graven image command, because we have made the image engraven. On the other hand, we follow these Israelites who forget at every turn, and who submit again to bondage, who find themselves in bondage. And especially like in categories of time, I see the world as so bound, so trapped and caught. And that's the point at which that word for me, which says remember, is a profound and wonderful word of freedom. I've got a Bonhoeffer quote, and I should have brought two Bonhoeffer quotes, because Bonhoeffer is also one who wrote marvelously about the freedom of Christians for civil disobedience and participated in plots to kill Hitler penitently, knowing it defied a God of life, and at the same time believing that the power of evil had become embodied there and needed to be stopped. But this is one he's written on freedom, and I thought fit the text. I just wanted to include it. If you set out to seek freedom, then learn above all things to govern your soul and your senses. Now, one of the other things here about the way he's going to use discipline is notice that he directs it for each of us at ourselves, not at our neighbor, which is where the law really becomes a sledgehammer. For fear that your passions and longing may lead you away from the path you should follow. Chaste be your mind and your body, and both in subjection, obediently, steadfastly seeking the aim set before them. Only through discipline may one learn to be free. We might have a marvelous argument about whether discipline is imperative or indicative. Every parent struggles with that mightily. Well, this has been a real privilege for me. I thank you for the week. I would want to be intent that we not say this end. My focus, as I've said before, is that we would continue to read the word, whether or not we can believe it. That our reading it is our most profound belief of it, and I like to think we'll continue to be united by this word, wherever our paths take us. Go ahead, please.